If you enjoy this podcast, don't forget to subscribe to catch all future episodes. Also, check out our YouTube channel at youtube.com/switchboxtv for video versions of this show, plus loads more videos covering sport, music, and lifestyle. That's youtube.com/switchboxtv. This episode was recorded in October 2020.
Can't believe he's with us. Great to see you.
Good to see you.
You do look like a news announcer. It's got to be said.
Oh God, it's so ridiculous. It's a new computer, and then I got a microphone so that I would sound better, and now I just look ridiculous. So
at the same time, it's one of those you say, "Gosh, wouldn't it be fantastic to interview the director on set?" But you are on set, aren't you?
I am. I'm on the set of my Instagram cocktail show. Exactly. So nothing like doing an interview right next to a sink. If I feel the need to purge, I'll let you know.
We've loved it. We've loved the cocktail show. How did it come about? What's your favorite cocktail?
Well, my favorite cocktail is definitely a martini. I'm a martini man. My passion for forever, and I've always been into cocktail culture, but that's really the drink that kind of got me into it, because I think it's sort of the most elegant drink, just the shape of the glass and just all the sort of the history around it and all. So yeah, so I love that, but I really got into doing the cocktail quarantine cocktail time because we went into quarantine. I was shooting a TV pilot in North Carolina back in March, and realized I had to shut things down because it was starting to get bad. And so came back to LA and just went, okay, well, I'm going to be in LA for months, stuck in the house. And, I can get a lot of writing done and get a lot of work done, but I also wanted to help in whatever way I could with, people going through this terrible time. And I'm not a medical professional, so I couldn't really volunteer to work at a hospital. But so that I realized, other than giving, donating money to causes and help, trying to help people that way, I could try to use what my only power, which is to entertain people. Hopefully I try to entertain people. Whether that power works all the time or not, that's up to you. But so I thought, okay, well, I love cocktail culture. I've always been wanting to kind of play around with cocktails. I collect a lot of cocktail books and always went, oh, I want to make that, but I never have time or never think to do it. It's like, oh, well, this is a chance to kind of go through the book. We'll make a new cocktail every day. We'll raise money for charity and we'll try to make people laugh and, forget about the pandemic for 15 minutes a day. And did it every single day for 100 days in a row. And now we do it about once a week, once every 2 weeks.
For people who maybe haven't seen it, what I love, how would you categorize or how would you describe your dancing ability? My daughter said it's definitely dad dancing.
There's some quality dad, possibly grandpa dancing going on, actually. it started out when I did the first show. I put on this Xavier Cugat song to start it out, and something kind of grabbed me. I just started doing a little dance, and it just became sort of people enjoyed it. So and I had fun with it. So it just became, I started doing a dance number at the beginning of every show. So I mean, it's ridiculous. But if you want to relive the madness, they're all up on my Instagram IGTV account, so you can see them all. There are definitely some good recipes in there.
Paul, we love you, but Laurie's the star.
I know. Tipsy fan, she wins every time. It's people just tolerate me. It's funny because you watch the comments and people are like, oh, yay. And then about 5 minutes in, it's like, where's Lori? Where's Lori? And I'm like, okay.
Well, coming in.
Yeah, that's right. I'm just second banana.
I've got to ask you a big one as well. When are we going to see Arting Stall's brilliant London dry gin over here? And have we got it over here yet?
No, it's not over there. Well, it is. It's technically in a few places, but oh man, if only it wasn't 9 o'clock in the morning here.
I know. I thought maybe my time. I was going to leave this till later, but I thought time-wise, you can't probably.
Do not.
Probably time-wise, I can.
Yeah, exactly. I know, but it's 5 o'clock there, so you know the rule. Please enjoy. No, I mean, it's my passion, my love. This I've been working on this for years, and now it's finally coming out. It will be. in London officially soon. What we have to do, and these are in America, I know all this stuff about booze now. In America, we sell our booze in 750 milliliter bottles, but in the UK, you sell yours in 700 milliliter bottles.
Right.
So if we get it wrong, they won't let us do it. So we have to, so we're in the process of molding a new bottle that is 700. And then we'll get our distribution ready and get them there.
In fairness, we've gone gin mad over here. We genuinely have, in terms of, you know, different flavors of gin, different flavors of tonics. I mean, I'd say that's a good time to be launching. But you are passionate about it. You've won awards for it, haven't you?
Yeah, we've already won like 4 awards. I mean, our very first outing, we won Best Gin in Show at this giant Wholesalers Spirits Awards. We've now gotten 3 other gold awards, and we've got 94, 93 ratings from various magazines and all that. So, no, it's, you know, look, I am very passionate about it. I know the gin is really taken off recently, but this has been like a 25-plus year quest to do this, because I've just always loved gin. Back when gin was more challenging, because it was just, you know, you just had Beefeater and, you know, Tanqueray and Gordon's, and that was kind of, you know, that was the basic range. And now what everybody realized is that gin can be a bazillion different things, because it's basically, at its core, and I hate to reduce it down to this, it's basically just kind of flavored vodka. That's very oversimplified, but it's those botanicals that go in, get steeped into it, that's what makes the difference. But that's why you can have a million different variations. And so we just settled on one that I wanted, that is the flavor profile I always wanted out of a gin and never found. So far it's working.
We're really hoping this pandemic goes away sooner rather than later. I've got, you were filming This Country, School for Good and Evil, Dark Army. What is coming up? What can you tell us?
Well, we're very close to getting This Country back up and running, since it's been put on hold, but we're in the final negotiations to kind of get a series pickup on that. So fingers crossed that we do that, because it's so, you know, I mean, the original show is so brilliant, and we really did find a way to translate it. We were in the middle of shooting the pilot when they had to pull the plug, and it was just going so well and so funny. And we actually, in the short time we were shooting, were able to shoot enough stuff to cut together like a 16-minute presentation reel that we used as our pilot, and people just went crazy for it. You know, and it's very respectful of the original one, but we found our own Daisy Cooper, you know, who is as unique of a voice, but still her own different voice. And that's the hardest thing, because I was involved with the American Office when it came over here, and that was the same issues. Like, how do you take a brilliant, perfect show and make it again? And it's just it's all about the people you cast. And having them have their own personality that's not too dissimilar from the original one, but still makes its own mark, so that they can be two different things and not just copies of each other.
You must be an expert, because it was one of the questions I was going to ask you. How difficult and how different, I've got my own thoughts on it, is the British humour to the American humour? I mean, there were times in Britain, The Office was so cringy, it was hard here. And I know, when you were involved over there with the US office, it took a while to get almost understood, if you like.
Yeah, the biggest difference is that, I found, my observation, is that British audiences really like unlikable characters, because they like to laugh at them, and American audiences don't. They need their lead character, their hero, to be ultimately lovable and redeemable. And so, you know, the first season of The Office, which was only 6 episodes, it was like a short season they did, they played it very much like Ricky Gervais. And if you look at the old episodes, they're very, very funny, but it's Steve Carell is very mean, the way that, you know, Ricky's character was. And audience was just like, no, they didn't want it. And it was really after Steve Carell came out in The 40-Year-Old Virgin that the network, first of all, it was all Kevin Reilly who was running the network at the time. He's the only reason the show survived that first season, because everybody else wanted to cancel it. But they all saw that, okay, Steve is a really, you know, lovable on-screen presence. So they didn't want to subvert the tone of the original Office, but they also needed to make it palatable to Americans and realize, okay, he could be a bore and all these things, but he still has to be well-meaning. And he has to kind of surprise you occasionally by actually being smart once in a while or doing the right thing once in a while, but that then allows you to be a boob, basically.
I mean, dinner party, the lovely thing about when I heard I was going to chat to you, I've had great chances to watch stuff I've never seen, stuff I've revisited. I mean, I've got a list as long as my arm of people going, well, you've got to ask him about this. But the dinner party episode, I mean, there's one moment when John Krasinski actually just looks at the camera. I don't know how many takes, or it was just a moment. It's just genius. I mean,
yeah.
You must actually love sitting around in a read through, just falling about laughing.
Oh yeah, I mean that was an interesting episode because that was, I think, the fourth or fifth season, and I was directing a lot of episodes, and I was actually on board as a co-executive producer on the show, helping not only to direct but then shepherd through new directors or directors on the people on the staff who had been given a show to direct, or some of the actors even. But that script, when we read it, I remember just, you know, going like, oh my God, this is the funniest script I've ever seen. But in my kind of comedy, which is very cringy and very like uncomfortable, which I love. comedy should be like a horror movie. You get to watch from a safe place something terrible happen to somebody. But it wasn't going to be me directing it. It was supposed to be another director. And I was just like, fit to be tied. Is like, how do I get this? And we can't. It's promised to this other person. But then, it sounds terrible to celebrate. A writer's strike happened, and that shut us down for months and months and months. And so when that was over, the other director had another job he was promised to. So I got to slide in and do it. And it was just one of the most fun things. You know, I directed 19 episodes of The Office, but that one was a real special one because it was almost like a little self-contained play. And the fact that it was all in this one small condo where everybody locked together, it was really, I mean, we laughed so much. I don't think I've ever laughed as hard. And we all had a hard time getting through it. The scene where he's showing off the little tiny TV and just the way we just shot it, like, oh, it looks big. And then you pull back and it's so small. We placed it really crappily on the wall. So it's not even kind of centered. And then that, you know, thing that pushes it. So we just had, I mean, it was tons of fun. It was challenging though. It was hot in there, I remember. And the other thing was that Angela was hugely pregnant at the time. So if you watch that episode, keep your eye on how we don't show her stomach and how we're always, she's holding flowers or has like a pillow on her lap or something.
what is there a point or is there a moment that must be when you go, this is it? I mean, I've done some great stuff, and say like The Office and all the episodes have their wonderful moments, but there must be, you just go, we've hit pay dirt here. This is the one.
Well, you feel that, but I've been in the business long enough to know that you feeling that doesn't necessarily translate to it being bad. You know, the first time I realized this was when I was an actor and I was on a lot of sitcoms, you know, in front of a live audience. And you would have these like brilliant show nights where the audience was on fire and you were killing. And like, it was just, you know, like a rock concert. And you're like, oh my God, this is going to be great. And then you'd watch it and it just didn't translate. You know, that energy didn't come across. It was almost like when you watch, like watching magic on TV. Like if you watch magic, you're like, oh my, I can't believe that on TV. You're like, yeah, well, they probably just fake that. Or, you know, it just doesn't look that good. Or watching even a play on TV from, you know, it just see everybody's talking too loud. It's like, wow, when I was there, it was great. So I just learned over the years, like, you can't ever count on that feeling. So that's why when you get in there, you have to make sure you get a lot of stuff. You know, and it's, I get, you know, this is one of my detractors, you know, say, oh, you just go in there and improv and they just make stuff up and blah, blah, blah. It's like, that's not true. We don't do that. But during the course of you know, work, you know, filming this script that we've worked so hard on, we have a lot of alternate jokes, alternate takes. Then I kind of go, like, what do you want to try something? Or I'll go, oh, like try this, or like, you know, so we'll try a lot of things so that when we get to the editing room, we've got a lot of different choices. So then when we get to the test screenings, then we go like, oh man, here comes that joke we know always kills, is going to destroy. And then like, oh my God, it didn't get anything. Then we go, take it out, put in another one, take it out, put in another one, until then you get with the one and they go like, oh my God, it laughs and go, we got it. And it's usually the jokes that you think aren't going to work, or you go like, oh, that's too dumb or not big enough, or, you know, just a million different things. I mean, I've had so many times an actor will go, oh, can I try one thing? After we've like exhausted a take, you know, I'm like, okay, we're done. And they're like, oh, I have one idea. And it's like, I've learned just like, sure, let's do it. Because 9 times out of 10, that will be the one. Even if they, when they do it, I go like, oh, that was stupid. We get back to the editing room. You're like, you know what? That was actually perfect. Because it was just like, they learned the scene, the ins and outs of the scene so much and got such new information from it that they were able to kind of crystallize it in this new take. So, you know, so the bottom line is never get too confident on the set.
And it was one of my questions. It fascinates me that eventually it must come down to you. If you're, especially if you're directing, it must be your gut feeling. That's funny. That works. Even though you've got a lot of people around. When you are filming, there must be times when you go, oh, that's the money. That's the one. But then do you go back and say, you know, can you just try another one? I mean, I've done stuff where I thought, I can't do it any better than that. And the director's gone, can you just do that? And I think, oh, for goodness. And I can never do it. I get annoyed and I can't do it as good again. It's difficult, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, what it is for me is, you know, I always say, like, the biggest fallacy in the world is when you watch movies about movies being made, and it's always like the director, like, and cut, that's it, that's the take, we're done. You know, it's like, every time I've done that, that's always been like the worst take. When you get in the editing room, it's like, what was I thinking? You know, because you're in the moment, you're trying to get something very specific that you see in your head. And what happens is a lot of times it makes you not see the forest for the trees, because you're so singular of mind in that moment that you're not able to kind of think about the whole organism that is a movie, a TV show, a piece of, you know, narrative storytelling. And so I've learned to work my way towards what I think is what I need. And the first thing I do is I don't rehearse. I don't even like to do kind of pre-rehearsals in the week leading up. I will generally do like, we'll do a read through a month or two before and then kind of go, oh, let's just like improvise as these characters. Cause I just want to find out how the people playing the roles are going to play them, you know, and try to see stuff that either they are aware of that they want to do or things that they might not even aware that they're doing that are just coming out. And then we'll go back and we'll rewrite the script to capture that. So I feel like once they get to the set, they're set up for victory. But then I just kind of set up the cameras and go like, let's just start, you know. And I even got to the point where I don't even let the camera crew like rehearse a take, because it's like, look, I don't want to. All I've had so many times where let's just do one rehearsal without the cameras, and you do it and everything's brilliant, and then you're like, oh, like we missed it, and then you never get it back. So I'm just like, I don't care if the shot's out of focus, just shoot it. So we'll fix it later. But then what I do is basically go like, let's just start. And what happens is we start with the actor's purest interpretation of how they think the character should be played, how they want to play it, how they maybe think we want it to be played. But it's a very raw, real performance. And a lot of times I go like, you know, to myself, I go, oh boy, that was terrible. Okay, how are we going to get to where I need to go? But it's fine, because then I go like, then I incrementally each take go like, try this, all trying to move them towards what I want, but I don't want to go and like, that's all wrong, throw that out, do this that I want. Because I know if I slowly adjust them, I'm going to get this full range of performances that when I get to the editing room, I go like, let's try this one, which was a 6. Let's try this one, that was a 4. Maybe we need this one that was an 8, you know, on the scale of 1 to 10 of what I wanted versus what I didn't think I wanted. And by doing that, you know, I'll eventually get to the performance I wanted, but I'll find, again, 9 times out of 10, what I thought I wanted isn't what was right, or it wasn't as good as what came out of those moments of people being in the moment and being real. So so I find it just works really well for me. And, you know, and some people, you know, I've done movies where some of the actors are just very need rehearsal, want rehearsal, and they feel very cut adrift by doing that. But I'm always like, look, I don't want to make you uncomfortable. I want to set up a very comfortable place for you, but just know you can't make any mistakes. So if you feel very weird about it, if it's not good, I won't use it. But some, it doesn't, you don't always know as an actor that what you're doing is great. Because you, again, like, just like I have an agenda of what I want out of it, you as the actor have an agenda of what you want out of it too. But we both might be wrong. And it might be somewhere in this middle place. And obviously, as an actor, you've got to be much more in control of what you're doing. But if you have a good director, and I, not that I'm, you know, but I will say I think I'm a pretty good director in that I know how to watch you and go, like, you don't know what you, if you don't know what you just did, I'm going to get you to keep doing that in other takes or in other parts of the movie, because that's what it is. And you will eventually start to go, like, oh, I get it. It's a very weird way to work. And some actors really get mad at me about it, but I feel like they always deliver a great performance at the end.
And how excited are you as a director, and how surprised when somebody like Melissa McCarthy will just, not so much improv all the time, but if you just come out with stuff that certainly you're not expecting, and you suddenly go, geez, that's bloody brilliant, you know?
Oh, those, I mean, that's the one of the reasons I do this, is for those moments where, you know, you just kind of, everything comes together, and it's always just a moment. It comes and it goes. And I've had so many times with Melissa and other people, but this happened a lot with Melissa, where we'll do these long takes of, like, try this, try that, and, you know, all this stuff. And we'll cut and go, like, oh my God, there's so much fun. It was so funny when you did X. And she goes, I don't even know what I just did, you know, because she's so in the moment. But that's my whole goal as a director, is to get you out of your head of, you know, there's nothing worse than the moment of, all right, everybody sound, everybody rolling and action, you know, because then it's just like, boom, and you're on, and it's not a natural thing. So that's why, you know, even though we will have our moment of acting, you know, and action, it's always like, okay, let's go again. Let's go again. Try this again. Let's go again right away, so that I don't have to call action, and it doesn't have to be this, like, buildup. It's just like, slide in, go in, you know, again, because then you're in the moment. And I love it if you don't know what you just did. That's great, because I know what you just did, and I recorded it. Anyway, I have it forever. And, you know, it's got to trust me that I'm going to get you through and not make you look bad.
We desperately try and not ask the same questions that you get asked a million times, but I can't not ask. I mean, how did the Bridesmaids Zoom watch-a-thon go? And how many times a day, a week, do you get asked, when are you making it? When's the sequel? When are you doing it? Come on, Paul, please.
Yeah, I know. We get a lot of requests for the sequel. You know, I always say, A, it's up to Kristen, because that was, you know, she wrote that. She and Annie wrote that. So, pardon me, that was their baby. But beyond that, you know, it's just, everybody thinks they want a sequel to everything and don't seem to not remember all the sequels that have let you down in your life, because sequels are really hard to do. Why are they hard to do? It's not just because the people doing them don't know, aren't talented enough to do it. That's not it. It's because the reason you fall in love with a movie is you are getting this first time experience with a person, meeting them at a point in their life where they have to solve something. That's all movies are. I mean, it's really about a story about a protagonist who's got to go through an experience and come out the other side a changed person. You know, unless it's just so action-packed that it's just about, you know, solving a problem. But something has to be solved, or else the movie doesn't exist for any reason. And so the reason Bridesmaids worked so well is we met this woman completely at a terrible point in her life. And she's trying to hold it together, and then she's going to lose her best friend, and she literally just completely goes into, you know, a tailspin, but is able to come out the other side stronger. Sure, we all love the dress shop scene. We all love the airplane scene.
Laurie's not at all. Laurie's not having
that. No, Laurie's not, exactly. she still kind of rolls her eyes at that one. But, you know, if the movie was all just that, the movie would not have worked. The movie would have been just people going, like, ugh, all right, people are throwing up and nobody needs to see that. But it was because you cared so much about those characters. And that dress shop works because it's not about, like, let's have a scene where everybody's throwing up and shitting in the sink. It's about somebody trying to compete with somebody who they're out of their league, you know, Helen, who's got all this money. So Kristen's like, I'm going to show off and take people to a crappy restaurant that I can afford, but I'm going to pass it off like it's great. Everybody gets food poisoning because of it. And now I'm going to refuse to admit that I screwed up in front of this other person against overwhelming evidence that I have. And so that's why it's funny, is because it's all around the center of, you know, you see, we go to the bathroom. Oh my God, everything's clearly a disaster. Then you come back to Kristen. I'm fine. I feel great. Nothing's wrong. Sweating, you know, and that's why it's funny. So, you know, again, it's lovely that people want a sequel, and there's no saying that it won't happen, but it's not such a like, hey, let's just do Megan's wedding this time. It's like, okay, there's gotta be something there more than just the trappings of the funny movie.
I was thinking Godfather 2 when I was going to ask it, when I was walking around today. I thought that
Sometimes it works.
Sometimes it does work. Sometimes it works.
You know, but then Godfather 3, so I'm just saying.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Don't push it too far. I loved A Simple Favor.
Thank you.
And I'll tell you why. Because if somebody said to you, if somebody went, it's a Paul Feig, Paul Feig's directed that, you can tell this. You could a little bit with Anna Kendrick's performance. I love that. There was still that little bit of humor and you know, the way she moved her body and her hands, etc. But yeah. I thought it was just a very different kind of film. Was it a deliberately different kind of film from your point of view?
Well, it was only in that that was the genre of the script that I fell in love with. And if you look at all my movies are genre movies. You know, I mean, it's, you know, The Heat is just a takeoff on a buddy cop movie, and Spy, obviously, and Ghostbusters, you know, all of those things, because I love that. I love these genres, but they've always been either very male dominated, or they've just had certain tropes or feelings about them that, or tone that I go like, that could be more this or that. And, you know, I love thrillers. Thrillers are one of my favorite forms of storytelling. Mm-hmm. I just love it. I love it because I just love that kind of like, what's happening? What next? What's happening next? And so when this script got sent to our company, it was basically from, at the time, Fox 2000 was saying like, we've got this script. I had a deal there. And so they're like, we got this script. It's a thriller, but is it a comedy? Like, we can't figure out what it is. Would you guys think about producing it for us? And so I was like, yeah, let me give it a read. And I read it. And I was just like, oh my God, I don't want to just produce this. I want to direct this because this is the thriller I've been looking for my whole life, which is a funny thriller. Because the character of Anna Kendrick, you know, Stephanie, I go, this is a nerd. This is a nerd stuck in a very high stakes situation. That I can relate to, you know, because I've read a lot of, you know, when I've said, you know, to my agents, like, I love thrillers, you know, they send me all these thriller scripts, but I'm just like, yeah, but this just feels like one of those movies, you know, kind of that you see all the time that are fun, but they're not really that fun. And so this is like, this I know how to do because I can make this funny in the way that Hitchcock movies were funny. You know, people forget that there was a lot of humor in Hitchcock movies versus the thrillers of today, which are so, it's so dramatic that you forget that they're ultimately kind of absurd situations, or they're situations peopled by very extreme characters. You know, it's not like normal people don't get caught up in a thriller. Maybe a normal person gets caught up, but then the people, you know, who are causing the thriller to happen are pretty extreme. Otherwise, they'd just be like normal people and wouldn't get involved in whatever intrigue there is. So that's what I just went crazy for. And I wanted to be, first and foremost, completely, you know, religious about the thriller genre. But then once we were, then I'm putting very extreme kind of funny personalities into that situation, and I just think it becomes more relatable because we're all kind of goofballs, you know, at the end of the day. And here's Anna Kendrick, who is this nerdy mom nobody likes, you know, all the other parents at the school think she's insufferable, but you kind of like, oh, I feel bad for her, like she's just trying to do the right thing. And then she gets swept into this giant thing, then you find out she's got this horrible secret from her past, you know. But it all plays into everything I love about subversion of storytelling and subversion of characters, because I really enjoy, and if you watch a lot of my movies, we do this all the time, which you introduce a character, especially since it's a genre, so you know already know the tropes and the stereotypes of the characters you're supposed to meet anyway. And you go like, okay, I know exactly who those people are. They're kind of, you know, stereotypes, and okay. And then suddenly, you know, within the first act or the end of the first act, you change it up and you're like, wait, I thought that person was this person. Now, and that's where the fun happens, of like just completely crushing those expectations in a real way. If this is where movies fall apart. If you set up the rules of these characters in the world, and then 30 minutes in, you go, now it's different. And the audience goes like, wait, what? It's good when they go like, oh my gosh. It's bad when they go like, wait a minute, because then you've lost them. It means you failed as a storyteller, because you've changed the rules, and you can't, once you set the rules, you can't change the rules.
You shouldn't have directed Mad Men. You should have been in it.
Well, you know, the irony was, when I showed up for my first day of prep, they go, "Oh, sir, the auditions are down the hall." I was like, "No, I'm actually the director. I'm sorry." Yeah, but that was a fun show.
I could see you in you know, a New York bar with Manhattan or you whatever. It would be bourbon, wouldn't it, and all that kind of thing. I mean, it's so atmospheric as much as everything else. I did want to ask you though, when you get asked to go in and direct something as successful as that, do you go in thinking, God, I mustn't knacker this up and get it wrong, or do you go in thinking, I want to put a Paul Feig spin on this particular episode?
No, well, what you wanted, here's the thing. I had the strange career trajectory of going from acting to having my own show that I created that I was co-running with Judd Apatow. So I skipped the entire part of kind of, you know, coming up through the leagues or whatever. Like, suddenly I had my show. And so I was thrust into this situation where, you know, we'd have a different director every week. I wanted to direct it, but they wouldn't let me because I didn't have the credits for it at the time. And so, you know, we bring in these directors, all great directors, very established TV directors, some that I knew personally and others that just had amazing resumes. But, you know, occasionally somebody would come in and go, oh, we're going to do this, we're going to change this up. And it's like, no, that's not the show. Like, you know, we worked very hard to set the template. You know, I just knew exactly what I wanted that show to look like, style, everything. And when Jake Kasdan came on to direct the pilot, we were so in sync. You know, we're just like, oh my, we just agreed. This is how it shouldn't have crazy fancy shots. It shouldn't have, you know, moving camera all the time. It should be about these performances. It should feel like a 70s TV show. And so then these other directors would come in occasionally and be like, all right, we're going to move the camera around. We're going to come up from here and all that. And it's like, that's not this show. And the ones who would then argue with you and go, oh, it's going to look like a TV show, which back then was a huge insult, because a lot of these directors were coming from, you know, we were all kind of, you know, we're all the same age, seeing the TV shows of the 60s and the 70s that were all shot very static. You know, they just looked very like a TV show, and movies were all about moving cameras and all this. So this generation of directors came in and started directing television and turning it into what movies were doing, with all these moving cameras and fancy shots. So to them, that's what, you know, made a TV show feel like a movie. But then for Jake, who was like 23 years old when he came in, the way that I was explaining, he goes like, wow, that's so cool. That's like a movie. Because to him, the cool independent movies were being shot like that. So it was this weird thing of like, you're fighting with, you know, and again, look, these directors were great and they were all very cool. But even that I had to go like, no, please don't do that. It gave me then, when I went into my TV directing career, the realization of like, don't come in and be a problem. You know, what you want to do is what you all, well, here's the other side of that. What you don't want is a director showing up and going like, all right, what do you want? How do you want me to shoot this?
Absolutely.
That's terrible. So you have to go in with this attitude of like, I have a plan. I see this thing. I have a spin I want to put on this, not necessarily to make it personal to me, but just go like, I think I can make this really good in a way you wouldn't expect. Get set for that, set it up, pitch it, whatever. If they go, cool, do it, that's great. And if they go like, that's not our show, go, got it, no problem. You know, either maybe at that point, like, you know, let me know what you don't like about it, or even like, okay, I know the show well enough, I'll shoot it this way. And that's how you have to face it.
I'm conscious of taking your time. I'll wind up with it. There's a few in Freaks and Geeks. You know, one of the things I was going to, does it matter if it stand? Does it stand the test of time? I was going to ask you, would it be a box office smash now if it came out? But do you know what? I had to laugh because does it stand the test of time? Joseph Flaherty, Harold Weir, in the first episode, the pilot episode. Girl in our school had premarital sex. Do you know what she did on a graduation day? She died. And I'm watching this. I'm going, Jesus, that's my dad. And then I showed it to my 13-year-old who's in teenage angst and just started a new school. I said, come on, watch this. Who does this remind you of? She went, oh, my God, it's you. And I went, you know what?
That's hilarious. Well, because that was based on my dad, you know. I would just like every story had some like tragic ending because he just wanted to affect my behavior. So God bless Joe Flaherty. So funny.
Brilliant. Listen, are you a worrier?
Yes. That's all I do is worry. I mean, if you look, I've got this one line right here that is like a
yeah. I've got
cavern.
About 18 and all that.
Yeah, yeah, and it's just from always, like, you know, furrowing my brow, if you will. Yeah, but you have to be. You have to be.
But why? I mean, you're out of movie jail. You'll never be back in movie jail. Your body of work stands. But do you know what I thought was fascinating? It was an interview you did. You were so worried, will Bridesmaids be a smash because you thought, I'm in movie jail here. And then it became such a fantastic, and you're so delighted. But then you started worrying about the next film before you'd even enjoyed the sort of success.
Oh, totally.
The current, because here's the thing. I don't want to flop again after being such a success.
Exactly. Well, here's the thing. You can always go back in movie jail, my friend.
No.
I'm not
seriously?
I'm telling you, this town is... It's fucking brutal there's always the feeling, especially as you're getting older, of like, when are they going to start to lose that connection to the audience, you know?
Uh-huh.
And what I find with every movie, in some way, the people in charge are going, is this the one where he's going to try to pull one over on us? You know, meaning, you know, I'm known as a commercial filmmaker. That's what I want to do. I want to make movies that make money for an audience and a studio, but are still really good.
Yeah.
There's always this weird feeling of like, is this the one where he's now going like, I'm going to make my art film, you know, or I don't care about the audience anymore. And it's crazy, but I'm telling you, and they would probably deny it. You know, they're all very wonderful, well-meaning people who are just guarding their investment. But, you know, and especially if you're a writer director, or even if you're like me, a director who, even though I won't take writing credit sometimes, you know, I still do a ton of rewrites on the movie.
Sure.
Because that's just what you do as a director. And there's always this feeling like, oh boy, now he's in love with his words. You know, he's not thinking straight. You know, he's going to screw us over, or he doesn't even know that he's going to screw us over, you know, or he's out of touch. And so that's why you're always constantly being harder on your stuff and what you're doing than the people around you are. And they're being really hard on you, you know?
Yeah.
So, and then there's the moments when you go, you do have these moments when you just kind of go like, I know this is right, but I'm not confident enough, going back to the beginning of our conversation, to say definitively, this will work and you're wrong, because maybe they're right, you know? And so what I just need to do is kind of, it has to make sense to me. But then, you know, I consult with a lot of people. I have a lot of people around me I trust to go like, is, you know, am I being belligerent? Am I wrong? You know, and
yes.
Tell me, like, I tell it, like, I don't want yes men around me. I like, tell me if I'm wrong, or tell me if there's even something in it that is a germ of something that maybe we don't even need, but it makes sense. That's what I want to hear. Because again, the minute I make something that nobody goes to see, I'm back in movie jail. You know.
Yeah, as good as your last gig, as they say. But at the same time as well, you come across as a person that's incredibly enthusiastic about wanting to do more, wanting to, you know, not so much try different things. Maybe you do, but, you know, that enthusiasm, and also it's this dreadfully underrated word, experience, as well. I don't know whether it's sort of damned with faint praise, but as a filmmaker, that must count for a huge amount.
Yeah, it does. It does, but it can also be your the thing that takes you down or makes you less appealing.
So there are also, did you see him dad dancing in his Instagram? Did you see him dad dancing?
I mean, I'm literally setting myself to be thrown out of the industry every time I do that show.
I'll make a great show.
But here's, and especially with comedy, you know, especially with comedy, I'll restate that, because comedy is constantly changing, and audiences' needs and wants and loves and dislikes of comedy is constantly changing. And so I've said this for years, you know, the minute you hear a comedy director, star, anybody go like, don't tell me what's funny, I've been doing this for X amount of years, you go like, well, set the watch, because you're about to get kicked out of the business. Because it changes, you know, and, you know, I've said this in other interviews, I apologize if I'm you know, repeating, but, you know, the most sobering moment I had in my comedy career was when I was directing The Office, and, you know, I was, they made me a co-EP on the show, and I said, like, I want to be in the writer's room more, and they're like, great. So I'm in there, and, you know, as a comedy person, you've got your go-to things that you just always kill with. You know, there's just certain things, jokes or style of joke that you do that you know is money in the bank. So we're at this table and they pitch out a thing that they want to try to punch up this joke. And in my head, I'm like, I got the killer. This is going to, because this is a joke I've done before. This is going to work. So they're going around the table. Everybody's pitching their thing. And I'm just sitting there like, all right, get ready. And they come to me and I pitch it and it gets dead silence. And I'm looking around this table of like 20 and early 30 year olds, and I'm in my mid 40s. And I go, oh my God, I just pitched out a dad joke. And it was horrifying, because you're like, wow, I'm on the verge of being obsolete. And then I watched them go around the room and find the right joke. And the right joke wasn't honestly that far off from what I pitched. It just, the way it was pitched, the way it was worded, the attitude of it was more contemporary, for lack of a better term. I don't mean like, oh, it's in vernacular. It just, it was at that moment, comedy was even more behavioral than the behavioral slash joke stuff that I liked. And so, but from that, I learned like, oh God, okay. So you got to keep consulting with people. You got to have a lot of things, you know, have to. Have, and so that's why sometimes experienced people go like, well, he's the guy, he's getting out of touch now. You know, so that's why
When you walked home and worried and thought, God, I've just gone old overnight, kind of thing. But now listen, I don't want to end on a downer, but you are our US correspondent.
Yes.
He won't get 4 more years, will he?
If he does, I'm moving permanently over there. Look, we're all traumatized by 2016, where we thought, you know, we had the win clinched, and then all of us, you know, sitting home that night just with our jaws dropping open and our stomachs
and
our
shoes. I'm here too.
Oh no, so, I mean everywhere. Everybody, every person. Yeah. But you know, the polls were off then, but in the looking back at it, the polls actually were a little more accurate than we gave them credit for. People just didn't kind of add them up and you know, kind of study them in the way that they should have. So now so much has been learned from that the polling that's going on now, and again, look, we're all traumatized by that. We're still saying get out and vote, because the last thing we want is like, all right, we're winning, so don't worry.
But
it does feel like we're on course to end this absolute madness. And he's just sounding like a lunatic.
$70,000 on that hair. I could have made him a rug.
I'm telling you, oh my God. Yeah, and you know, but they found that actually deducting that is criminally, possibly a criminal offense. So if he goes to jail because of his hair, will there be any more perfect ending for this ridiculous regime?
We're all hoping. I'm afraid it's not an Artings Stalls, but it's a decent, there you go. It's a decent drink. Listen, thanks for joining. I'll toast you.
Cheers. Cheers. Clink.
Cheers to you. Listen, thanks for joining us. You take care of yourself. Love to all over there. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. And hopefully we'll talk again soon, very soon.
I would love that.